Okay, good morning, everyone. This is week three of emotional wellness. Just before I begin, just in case I forget at the end, which I often do, once I get into the shiur, I forget things that I'm supposed to say. So I'll just mention it now, but I'll try and mention it again, just in case people come in a bit late. So this was going to be a five-week series. At the end, however, this is week three. And next week, we're still on, week four. But after that, actually, it's a long story, but I'm actually going overseas for a couple of weeks. And then the summer hits. So next week will be the last one for this year, actually. But what I am going to do is, and you can take a little fly at the end, I'm going to do an eight-week mini WhatsApp series throughout the summer. I've called it Lessons from the Days of the Week. So we're going to, each week we'll post something. I'll post it on a Thursday, actually. So that we learn different lessons from the days of the week in our sources. Each day has its own lessons, which is very interesting. I'm going to do that. It's going to be posted on WhatsApp and some other places. If you want to join the WhatsApp group, some of you are on that group already because I've used it before in the summer. It's called Weekly Personal Growth. But if you're not on it, I've got a little flyer here. You can take it at the end. Just you can scan. Is a scan thing? What's it called? A barcode? Whatever.
QR.
QR, that's it. Sorry. thanks. So you can get onto the thing, or you can just, if you're not sure how to use it, because you're a bit like me, so there's a mobile number, you can just text a word, and then you can join the WhatsApp group. If when you join the WhatsApp group, it's not letting you join, it probably means you're on it already, that's why. So it's not rejecting you, it just means you're already on it. Okay, I'm just going to close this window. Okay, so I want to just begin with a quick review. So last week we talked about loneliness. And we explained that alone and loneliness are two separate things. Loneliness is very, very bad for a person. Connection is the basis of our experience. There are various strategies like volunteering, connecting with other people, investing in friendship, being active, animals even, and so on. But last week we explored a deeper dimension in combating loneliness, and that is the connecting to the deeper part of ourself. And once we do that, we connect to the soul, which is really the divine infusion that we have, and we realize that we're connected to everyone, which we're going to talk about more today. We're connected to everyone. We are part of a common purpose, we're a small piece in a big puzzle, and that really we're never alone because we always have that purpose and God with us all the time. And we ended off by talking about I'm mentioning that because we're going to get into that a bit more today, of every person having a unique relationship with Hashem, with God and His purpose. Okay, so this week I want to go on to the next chapter of the book, which is really a bit of a continuation of last week. I want to elaborate today on this idea that we said last week, that everyone has a unique purpose, a unique role, a unique relationship with God, a unique contribution, to understand what that actually means. And when we do understand what it actually means, it's actually quite, it's not an easy idea that we're going to share today, but it's an empowering idea and a strengthening. What do we mean actually when we say that everyone has a unique role? What does that actually mean? And I'm going to spend a bit of time giving a very foundational introduction to this whole idea so we understand it properly. Because we have touched on this many times, but I'm not sure we've ever clearly sort of developed what does it mean when we say that every person has a unique purpose? What does that actually mean? Particularly from a Jewish perspective. So we're going to revisit and elaborate on a couple of very fundamental ideas. So first of all, you know, millions of times we've talked about Viktor Frankl, right? That every person is wired deep down and has a very solid need to live a life with meaning and purpose. Everyone needs meaning. And not everyone necessarily pursues a life of meaning, right? This is very much summarized in a letter that the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote in 1961, and he said that there's two approaches to life. This we've talked about a lot, but I'm just going to give this as an introduction. One approach to life is to consider it as a matter of pleasure, in which case every effort should be bent towards getting the most out of life in terms of our own pleasure, in every situation to see what is easiest for us and to take the easiest way out, right? Second is to, not that pleasure is a bad thing, by the way, just that sometimes that's the pursuit of that in a big way, right? The second is to consider life as a challenge and to help make a better world that we live in, especially since the society we live in is far from perfection. In this case, every effort must be made, must be bent towards this end, even if it means sacrifice of certain personal pleasures, and even if it requires a great deal of continual physical and mental exertion, right? So these two ideas, this concept of pleasure and purpose, essentially they come from two driving forces within ourselves, as we've mentioned many times. This is based on the book of Tanya, where he talks about the two souls, the two warring souls in that we have, and that's part of our struggle the entire life, is the conflict between these two souls, the godly soul and the animal soul. So the animal soul is where ego lives, and it's the animalistic part of our experience, and it's the part of us that just looks for self-preservation, self-pleasure, what is pleasurable, what feels good, what is easy at the time, right? Without necessarily considering consequences or considering effect, impact on other people, and so on. It's about self, right? That's what it is. So however, the godly soul is where humility lives, where meaning lives, where a life of higher purpose lives, and a connection to God lives, right? Which really is an important introduction to the concept that I want to talk about, because to understand what is the Jewish perspective when we say that we all have our personal or unique or special purpose and contribution in life. Because what I want to explore for a few minutes is what actually is the Jewish view on that, right? It's talked about a lot today, about people finding their own path and so on, but what is the Jewish view in that? So on the one hand, right, on the one hand, as we said last week, every person does have a unique, not only purpose, but a unique relationship with God, right? I quoted that passage from the 12 passages, the famous 12 passages, that Hashem is standing over us and looking at us and examining at us if we're close to Him and so on. In other words, He's standing over every individual, so to speak, that is that unique relationship that we have and therefore the unique purpose. It's also clear that the individual and the individuality of each person is of paramount importance in Jewish thinking. I'll give you a couple of ideas, right? First of all, the Talmud tells us that the reason that the human being was created singular, right? God created every animal, a couple, male and female, but He created Adam first as a singular person and then Chava and then Eve. Why? Why did it happen that way? Why did the person need to be created as a single entity? To teach us, says the Talmud, that every individual is an entire world. And therefore the Talmud says, whoever destroys nefesh achat, one soul, one person, the Torah considers it as if he has destroyed an entire world. And conversely, whoever saves or helps or assists or keeps alive nefesh achat, one singular soul, ki'ilu kayem, it's as if he has created, sustained, saved an entire world, right? In other words, every individual is a full world. But the question is, what does that individuality actually mean? Today, in popular secular culture, there's a lot about finding your own way, being your own person. You know, Brené Brown talks about it a lot, right? Does it mean... Because they talk about the importance of being yourself, finding your own purpose, finding what works for you, finding your own way, and so on and so forth, right? Is that the Torah view? So let's explore this. Because while we say that individuality is so important in Jewish writing, in Jewish philosophy, it's interesting because we need to think about that in contrast with the idea that actually if you look at it, Judaism, the Torah as a moral guide, as a moral compass, is actually very prescriptive, right? More so than any other religion, probably, right? We are in Judaism, and this is obviously, none of us are perfect, and everyone's in their own journey, and whether we keep everything or not, that's not relevant to this discussion. But in honesty, we know that the Jewish principles, we have 613 mitzvot, right? And Jewish law and Jewish guidance and Jewish practice governs minutiae. Details are the way we live, right? Not only tells you to make Kiddush Friday night, tells you exactly how to make Kiddush Friday night. How big the cup's got to be. How much wine you have to have in it. How much of the wine do you have to drink, right? How do other people get covered? How do you have to say, I'm just giving one tiny example, right? Got to put a mezuzah on your door. There's, I don't know how many laws governing how mezuzah has to be written, which is why it's so expensive, right? Because it's very labor intensive. Each letter has many, many laws governing it. And we have many, and now granted, we don't keep all 630 laws today because no one keeps all 630 laws anyway, because some of them are for men, some of them are for women, some of them are for Kohanim, Levi'im, and also today we don't keep many because we don't have a temple. So many of them are related to the temple and temple times. But there's still plenty that we keep, plenty of do's and plenty of don'ts, right? There's volumes on Shabbat, there's volumes on Kashrut, right? So one could suggest, and I've been asked this many times, that where's the room for individuality? Like we ideally, we're all given the same set of rules, right? Same set of values, actually. Okay, there's disagreements and there's disputes, and the Talmud has lots of different conclusions and different, but the skeleton of it is all the same, really, right? Just details, sometimes people differ, but we all have a single moral compass that we're supposed to follow, we're supposed to subscribe to, right? We're supposed to grow towards, put it that way, okay? So how does that fit in? That's the question I wanted to talk about, to understand what the individuality actually means in Judaism. How does that fit in to everyone has a unique purpose, and the individual is so important? And understanding the individuality of our own experience is so important, right? Because we need to know, like, what do we do? We need to know ourselves, one would imagine, to understand what our individual purpose is, our individual contribution is. Everyone has different talents, everyone has different personality, everyone has a different way of doing things, right? And it's important to recognize that, not to... So to put it differently a little bit, we talk on the one hand, we talk about surrender, you know, matzah, we often talked about the idea of matzah, has no ego, we surrender our ego because we surrender to a higher purpose. On the other hand, we say that the individual is really, really important. So how does that actually fit together? How does that work? And I think it's an important foundational principle to understand, just in terms of understanding what that great individual contribution is all about. In other words, how do these concepts come together? How does the prescriptiveness of Judaism and the individuality come together, right? And we need to understand this very, very clearly, because only then we can understand what the unique contribution is all about, really. So here's the principle, briefly. It goes like this. And let's go back to these two types of living. A pleasure, the pleasure way of living, and the life of meaning, right? So the pleasure, we say pleasure, that's about me. It's about what's good for me, right? Now, people who live a pleasure type of life, it doesn't mean they live a hedonistic life necessarily. I mean, often it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. But it does mean that they live a life that is focused on themselves. What I mean by that, what's the difference? Because sometimes people can do very good things, but it's good things that work for them. It's good things that they like doing, right? So obviously I'm talking, there's everything in between. Often when we talk about these things, it's always good to talk about extremes, otherwise it's not clear, right? So I'm talking about the person who lives only for themselves, I'm talking about the person who lives only for a higher purpose. Most of us are neither extreme, right? But it's just important to sort of clarify. So the person who lives for themselves, that's what works for them. Could be good things, could be helping other people, could be volunteering in Africa, could be who knows what, right? It could be lots and lots of amazing things, but it's what they like doing or what works for them. In a worse scenario, it's not such valuable things altogether, it's just a pleasure, a hedonistic lifestyle. Okay, that's an extreme of living for oneself, living for pleasure. But even if it's more subtle than that, even if it's more valuable than that, or if it's more noble than that, it's still about being locked in ourselves. Which, by the way, ourselves, the self of us, is extremely limiting. Because we are limited people. We are finite people. Even if we're very talented and very clever and very capable, we are still limited and very, very finite. Right? When you live a life of meaning, however, the principle of living a life of meaning means that we're prepared to go beyond ourselves. And that's that phrase that were used in that letter. It means the ability sometimes, it means that you have a morality, you have a focus of what meaning and purpose looks like, and you're willing to live for that purpose, even if it means being uncomfortable, even if it means doing the things you don't like to do. Right? In other words, living a life of meaning means to have the ability to go beyond oneself to, for the greater good. Which expressed itself, like I said, to be uncomfortable. Sometimes it means to submit and surrender to things that we don't understand, that don't make sense to us. In the recognition that us, we live in this space, we live in this little bubble of this world, and our intellect and our cognition and our ability to think is wonderful, but it's very limited. And there's things which are higher than that. Like Rabbi Sachs explains, that we've talked about this a number of times, when he defines the concept of morality, he says that morality cannot be created by people who live that morality, because then it's subjective. In other words, morality has to come from a space that is a level that is outside of our existence. Which is why he talks about the concept in Judaism where we have absolute morality versus subjective morality. Because we are very limited. How can we create our own moral code? So if a moral code has got to come from something higher than ourselves, an existence that transcends the existence of this universe, of this world, right? That's what living a life of meaning is, right? Therefore, the foundation of life, before we get to, if we want to live a life of meaning, if we want to have that goal and purpose, or as Viktor Frankl tells it, really tapping into our essential need, right? Because the paradox of living a life of meaning, by the way, is that we don't live a life looking for pleasure and happiness necessarily. We look for a life of meaning and purpose, which in turn gives the real happiness. It's a separate discussion, but I remember, I think we did this a while ago where Tal Ben Shachar talks about the pursuit of happiness. He says the people are not happy, the people that pursue happiness, right? Because if you pursue happiness, again, same idea. When you pursue happiness, you're pursuing something that you want, right? Whereas if you pursue other things, things of purpose, you're pursuing a higher meaning, which in turn brings the real happiness. So therefore, looking for happiness has to be a life where you don't pursue happiness. You pursue those things that bring happiness, which is things outside of ourselves, things that are higher than ourselves, right? What that means, however, therefore, is that the foundation, which goes back to the prescriptiveness, perhaps, or the apparent prescriptiveness of Judaism, well, it's not that prescriptive, I just wanted to strengthen the question. There's plenty of room to, right? There's plenty of scope for individuality in Judaism also, but the foundation is prescriptiveness, and the reason for that is because before you can use and contribute with your own strong and unique and special individuality, we first have to submit to the higher purpose, which is a common purpose. In other words, the essentials, the foundation of the common purpose is not individual. And that is true. That's why we all have the same mitzvot. That's why we all have the same values. Because the purpose that we pursue is actually not an individual purpose. It's a common purpose. And then once we submit and once we surrender to the common purpose, the common higher purpose, then each one has a very strong component of individuality to contribute to that common purpose. Does that make sense? Right? An analogy is one I've given before in a different context, but the same idea. A symphony, an orchestra, right? Which is everyone's playing a different instrument, which sounds different, and every instrument contributes a different. I'm not such a musician, so I can't really explain this, but every, right? But we all know, even us simple people, right? Every instrument contributes a very, very special component, a unique component, an individual component to the symphony. And the symphony is made up specifically of different instruments, otherwise it's not as beautiful. It's not symphonic unless there's different instruments, which all sound the same. All sound different, right? However, it's only beautiful when there's a conductor and everyone's playing to the same melody. So in other words, they're playing to the same music, they're playing to the same arrangement, they're following the same conductor, and in following the same conductor to produce a common result, whatever the symphony is, each one is then contributing an individual and a special and a unique sound of music. And that's how Judaism works. The beginning of Judaism is, the foundation of Jewish thinking is that there is a surrender. That's why we begin Pesach, which is the beginning of the cycle of the Jewish journey, with matzah, which is getting rid of the ego. And later on, we don't eat matzah all year. We do introduce the individual. We get rid of the ego to reintroduce our individuality in order to contribute, to be a piece of the puzzle of that overall and higher sense of purpose and meaning. Am I making sense? Okay. This idea, by the way, is expressed in so many different areas of Jewish thinking. I'll just give you one or two examples. The Jews left Egypt and they journeyed in the desert for 40 years. God told them to build a sanctuary, build a Mishkan, it was called, right? That it would be a place where God would dwell. And the famous phrase, it was very intricate building, how it had to be built, and everyone had to contribute towards it, and so on. And God said, "V'asu li mikdash, make for me a temple, v'shachanti betocham, and I will dwell among them." And the famous question is asked in Hasidic philosophy and other sources, what does it mean? The grammar is funny. What do you mean, I will dwell among them? It should say, I will dwell among it. Make for me a sanctuary, I will dwell in it, right? It doesn't say that. It says, make a sanctuary, I will dwell in them. So the commentaries explain that the sanctuary, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was just a model for everyone's personal Mishkan, for everyone's personal sanctuary. We all have to build a temple in our home, in our own experience, in our surroundings, right? We're all builders to make the world a more godly place and to invite meaning, purpose, value, godliness into the world to make the world a better place, a better planet, right? In the contribution, there was something very interesting. So the Mishkan was built with these beams, very, very heavy beams made out of acacia wood. And the way the beams stood, because it wasn't a permanent structure, they used to dismantle it and reconstruct it whenever they would travel. They traveled 42 times during the desert, right? So how did the beams actually stand? So the way the beams were shaped, they were designed in a way that was a huge beam. At the bottom, it had like two individual pillars that came out of the beam. And those was carved to make two pillars. And that those two, whatever you call them, those two protruding pillars would then be inserted into a very, very heavy silver socket, right? Which was the foundation of the temple. That was the foundation. It's called Adanim. So the way it was built, it's a very fascinating Kabbalistic principle. The way it was built was as follows. God asked everyone to donate according to their own means, how they can, what they wanted to donate. Materials, for there was like 15 different types of materials, gold, silver, copper, wool, all kinds of goatskins, all kinds of things that was used to build this tabernacle, wood, and so on. In order to construct the adanim, the sockets, the silver sockets, that was done by every single person donating the exact same thing, a half a shekel. Every family, every person donated a half a shekel, silver, a half a silver shekel, that was then taken and melted down, and the melted down silver was used in order to create those sockets that was the foundation of the Mishkan. For the rest of the Mishkan, the beams, the curtains, the vessels, everyone donated whatever they wanted. Right? The men, the women, everyone donated what they wanted to donate. The amount that they wanted to donate, what they wanted to donate, was all different. And the commentaries explain that there's a very, again, if we take the Mishkan as a symbol of our own personal Mishkan, it's the same thing. There is a baseline common purpose where we're all equal. That's the sockets. When it comes to sockets, there was no individuality. The sockets was the foundation, the surrender to a common purpose, the commitment to live a life of meaning, and the commitment to transcend our own finiteness and our own limitations. To surrender, to submit to something higher than ourselves. I know that we've talked about surrender before. It's a very dirty word nowadays in today's culture. But not in Judaism. Surrender is considered a healthy thing. Why is it considered a healthy thing? Because it's not meant as a loss of self. It's meant a graduation of self. It's meant the idea of going beyond ourselves to connect to something higher than ourselves. Which is why, as we've talked about many times, why some of the mitzvot in the Torah do not have reasons. And they don't make any sense. And we do them because they don't have reasons and they don't make any sense. Right? That's why we keep them. That's why they're there. Because they're there as a... God wants us to understand. He gave us plenty of mitzvot to understand and to internalize and to analyze, because He wants us to be there. He wants us to be present. He wants us to understand. He wants us to be fully present. But He also wants us, as an introduction, to be willing to grow. And willing to grow means to do things that we don't understand. Right? I've often shared this with you. Kashrut, for example, is one of those examples. It doesn't have a reason and doesn't make any sense, and it's definitely not for health reasons. I know this for a fact. Okay? I eat it. There's nothing healthy about Shmalserim, promise you. Or even a good Shalt on Shabbos. I mean, it's good. It's really good if you make it properly. But there's a separate mitzvah to be healthy, by the way. That's a separate mitzvah. Right, so moderation, and yeah, you know, once in a while, Shabbos, not during the week, all that kind of stuff. But not, kashrut has nothing to do with being healthy, right? So why do we have to keep kashrut? Don't know. That's why we keep it. Okay, there's Kabbalistic symbolisms and all kinds of interpretations, but that's not the reason, right? And many other ones, like the red heifer, and lots of things, right? But that is the foundation. That's why, to broaden that idea, there is a prescriptiveness in Jewish thinking, because it's designed for us to, well, it's designed for many reasons, we don't know why each mitzvah is given to us, but is that concept of absolute morality and a moral code that comes from a higher place and meaning and connecting to something transcendent beyond ourselves, where we can't choose our own individuality because our individuality is limited, it's part of us, right? The other example of where this is so, this is true about relationships and it's true about everything, but about individuality and yet being part of a common purpose, is the way we write the Torah scroll or mezuzah. I've mentioned this before. That when we write the letters, one of the halachot, one of the laws of writing a mezuzah or writing a Torah scroll or writing tefillin, is that you need to have all the letters there and they all must follow a particular code, they must be written a particular way. And yet, one of the laws is that each letter must stand alone. It's called mukaf gvil. It must be surrounded by blank parchment. If you have a Torah which has over 300,000 letters, right, and one letter is attached to another letter, even with a very thin line of ink, you could fix it, but at its present status, it is invalid. You cannot use that Torah scroll on Shabbat to read from. It's pasul, it's invalid. It's an invalid Torah. It's a beautiful Torah, it could be unbelievable. But if it's touching another letter, it's pasul. You can fix it, but it's invalid, right? Why? Because we say that every person has a soul. Every soul corresponds to another letter in the Torah. And although we have to be part of the whole, we can't do our own thing, there is that foundation of surrender. So therefore, we are governed by the how you write the Torah and how you design the Torah and how it's all written. And all the letters must be there. And we all affect each other because we all submitted to a common purpose. Yet, every letter must stand alone because every letter is an individual. Okay. So that's how those two things come together. Now, how does that play out? So it works like this, going back to the animal soul and the godly soul, right? Or as it can be expressed in a different way, our soul and our body, or our soul's needs and our bodily needs, or our conscious personality, right? So when we talk about the war between the animal soul and the godly soul, the animal soul is not godly, the animal soul is egocentric, but we are taught very clearly that the animal soul, and by extension the body that the animal soul gives life to, is not evil. It's not bad. It needs to be trained, like an animal. If you leave an animal untamed, it can be very destructive, right? When an animal submits to the guidance or the training of a human being, the animal can actually be amazingly constructive and amazingly helpful, and can play an incredibly important role. And the same thing how it works within our own life experience. Living a life of purpose means living a life based on the soul, not on the animal soul, the godly soul, not the animal soul. But it means that the godly soul directs, the godly soul guides. It means that we become selfish rather than selfish. We into purpose rather than pleasure. Right? We're able to go beyond ourselves rather than being stuck in ourselves. But it doesn't mean that we discard the value of the animal soul. Because it's the animal soul or our animal consciousness where we're actually so different from each other. And that's okay, that's good. Difference is important. Individuality is important. Every instrument is important, provided they're following the conductor. So think of yourself as the godly soul and the animal soul. The godly soul is the conductor, right? Because the animal soul is godly and it's connected to the ultimate conductor. Our animal soul, our animal consciousness, our physical being, everything that we do in life that might not come directly from our godly self, it might just be regular routine, mundane living, including the important parts of living like having a job or doing business, or whatever the case is, sleeping, eating, all those things are all critically important, provided that they guide it, they become an instrument in their overall orchestra, and they become an instrument that they can contribute to their overall purpose, right? Which means that's where difference is so important. Our godly soul, at least at its root, at its core, is not so different. Our godly soul is godly. We all have, not in the manifestation, not in our cognition and emotions, but at the core of the godly soul, we're all one, which is what connects us already, right? But that's fine. But where does difference play out? Mainly in our physical consciousness and our physical experience. We are all tremendously different. And that's important. In other words, once we win the war, so to speak, once we overcome our ego, and once we're committed, and by the way, it's not something that happens once. I mean, once our mindset is to try and climb the ladder of living a life of more purpose and more selflessness and more meaning rather than more pleasure, more egocentricity, then what we also do is we try to then harness the differences, the individuality and the uniqueness of each animal consciousness and each physical consciousness to contribute to the overall purpose in a very unique and special way. I hope that's clear, yeah? Okay. It's because all our differences are really critical to our shared mission. That's how it works, right? That's why the foundation is prescriptive. The foundation is a surrender. But then the contribution, the unique contribution of every person to that overall shared purpose is so important. Now, this results and manifests itself in so many different things. So let me go through three or four ideas. First of all, what that means is that once the guiding force of our life is purpose, rather than hedonism or selfishness, then part of that comes with a belief, the godly belief, that nothing happens randomly, right? As we said last week. And therefore, everything that we possess is for that purpose, right? In other words, wherever we are and wherever we land up, it's all critical to our purpose, right? Because Kabbalah teaches us that each person, we are here to make this world a better place, right? To make it more godly and meaningful and purposeful. So we have a concept that each person is given a different animal soul, and each person to refine and to tame and to elevate, and each person is given a different part of the world, meaning a different part of the physical experience to work with, right? That's why people do move from place to place, but actually, the idea is that wherever you are now, sometimes, of course, there's reasons to move, right? We don't stay in one place all our life, but we do believe that where we land up was a reason. We're never in a place, we're never in transit. There's no such thing in Judaism. We're never in transit, right? Because when you're in transit, you don't give it your full attention, right? In other words, we're never living, some people are always living, you know, I'm going to be here now for 2 years and then 3 years and then in 10 years, that's when I'm going to arrive, right? That's a completely non-Jewish idea. An un-Jewish idea, I should say, right? Judaism is not such a thing. You're here now, even if it's only you plan to be for 3 years. When I say here, I don't even mean physically. I mean, you're doing one thing now. That's your purpose. That's your full purpose. You heard me say many times in Judaism is not such thing as a means to an end. Wherever you are is where you're meant to be, and it's you're meant to be for the purpose you are. For the purpose you're created. You've got to find that purpose sometimes. You've got to see how that geographical destination or that experience that you're in can be used to strengthen your purpose or the common purpose that we all share, yes, that could be a task sometimes. It's not always easy. But where you are is where you're meant to be. There's a pasuk, a verse that says, Mehashem mitzadei geber konanu, which means God guides the steps of the human. He leads us. We think we make plans, but ultimately we land up where God is leading us. Our choice is then how we're going to use that, stay there. How are we going to be there, right? There's a rabbi in Melbourne. His name is Rabbi Glick, Rabbi Avram Glick. For many years, he was the principal of the yeshiva school there. I know him quite well. I studied in Melbourne for a while. I studied under him for a while. And there's a fascinating story with him. He, when he got married, so he spent a few years in Worcester. That's where his wife was from. He was from Australia. Worcester.
England.
No, America. Massachusetts. How do you pronounce it? Massachusetts. Yeah. Worcester's a town. In the States. I can't explain to you, geography was never my strong subject in school. By the way, I've got to tell you, I did something amazing the other day, just while we're talking about that. The first time I was with my daughter, we had to go to Westfield. I couldn't find parking. I actually went to the next floor. It's a place I don't know. And I found my way back. You just know. I'm very proud of it. I actually found my way back. I told you, I only park in one place in Westfield. Like, I go around and around until I find it, because I never know if I can find my car.
It's not good for your cognition. Westfield is actually...
I know, but I'm scared of losing my car.
That's the idea.
Okay, so I did it. I'm just reporting back. I'm pushing my boundaries. Okay.
You can turn the phone.
Yeah, just press that green button. Sure. Sorry. Sorry, I should have closed it. Okay, so... So I'm just saying that directions and geography is not my thing. But anyway, so this rabbi, when he got married, he was doing some stuff in Worcester, but his ultimate plan was, you know, that's where his wife was from. The ultimate plan, he was going to move to Melbourne to run some of the Chabad activities there, to be the school, whatever, an educator, etc. So he was destined to leave. He was going to leave. The plan was to leave. He was winding down the Jewish year. He was going to leave after the Chagim. One year, this is many, many years ago, he was going to leave after the Chagim, and he was going to move to Australia. So he happened to have an audience with the Rebbe. In those days, the Rebbe would take, once a year, people could have a private audience with him. And the Rebbe asked him the question in the audience. He says, as you know, the Rebbe was quite demanding when it comes to this kind of stuff. And he said to him, what kind of activities do you have planned for the month of the Chagim? Just before the Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, you know, what's the activities? What are you doing? What kind of programs are you going to run? He said to the Rebbe, look, he didn't plan really anything because he's leaving right after Sukkot. It's like, you know, he's done. You know, you say someone's checked out like long before they leave, like he's finished. No, he's done. And the Rebbe became very serious and said, I don't understand. What do you mean? But for the next month, you're there. And if you're there, that means that's where you're supposed to be. And that's where you're supposed to be fully. And do as if you're going to be there forever. And he gave a very interesting, we talked before about the Mishkan, right? About the tabernacle in the desert. What used to happen was they would travel during the desert. They were there for 40 years. They had to travel, right? And each time there was a whole thing that when they had to travel, the cloud, the godly cloud would lift and they were able to travel. And then it would come back and they knew that to stop. And this happened 42 times. So the Jews camped in different places. How long did they camp on each place? It varied. There was one place they were there for 19 years. That was the longest. And there was one place that were there for one day. God knows why. He knows why, right? That was his plan. And the Rebbe said, you know, whenever they camped, it was by God's instructions. That's what it says. It was godly directions. But wherever they camped, they had to reconstruct the entire Mishkan because it all got packed away. They had to put it up. It was a huge task. And then when the cloud lifted, they had to dismantle it and pack it up and people had to carry it. It was a whole thing. And God asked them to do that. In other words, when God dropped them off there for one in the morning, he said, here, stop. One day, one night, whatever the case is, because if you're in a place for one day, you've got to build a Mishkan. You've got to make a better place. He says, what do you mean you're leaving after the Chagim? But now you're here. So for the next month you're here, you've got to be as if you're here forever. After Sukkot, you'll leave. But right now you're here, which means you're here forever. So this is one of the principles that everything that happens, and you're here because you have a special job to do. You have a special talent. You have a special individual. unique contribution to make that no one else can make for you, and you landed here because you need to do it. You need to participate. That's the first idea. Second idea is, if we all share a common purpose, but we all have a unique contribution to make, one of the mistakes people make often is that they think to contribute to a purpose means it has to be something very big. And it doesn't. Because often the small contribution and the small things that we do are as big and as important as the big things, right? Because, and this is, see, this is where it becomes so empowering and so important, knowing that whatever we do, we're actually part of a common destiny, a common purpose. But my contribution to that common purpose is very critically important and unique and vital for the overall, for every piece counts, right? I mean, just, you can understand this from machinery. You can have a machinery where, you know, a very, very important machine which has complex parts to it. And of course, the main thing is the main mechanism of the machine or the engine, whatever the case is. But if one screw is missing, the thing doesn't work, right? So the person putting in the one screw, or that one screw, as small as it might be, is as vital at the end of the day and as critical to that big machine. And that's such an important thing. And therefore, because we understand that our unique pathway is not just a small person. See, if you're just an independent person, if you're an individual from beginning to end and you have no connection to anything else, and you're just you for yourself, then of course you're going to want your path to be very significant. Or you're going to want your path to be recognized as something very significant. Because otherwise I'm nothing. But if your small contribution, if you believe that this is what you can contribute, or this is what you've tried your best, or you've gone a little bit beyond your comfort zone, but this is what you do, that small contribution is as important as the major contributions. Not everyone has to make a revolution in the world. Not everyone has to discover something big. Not everyone has to do something absolutely, truly amazing, right? It's inspiring when that happens, but the small things that we do, the hello you say to someone else, the talents that you use for a good purpose, even in your own small circle of influence, is as critical as important to everything, because every little thing counts. I saw a beautiful story I want to share with you quickly. It's called Every Note Counts. It was written by a rabbi. It doesn't say his name in the article. It's on an h.com website. It's called Rabbi P for some reason. And essentially it involves a guy called Richard. And this guy, Richard, had met him in a summer camp. So every summer, you know, in America, everyone goes away for the summer. This Rabbi P would go away to a campsite or whatever. And he would give a daily Talmud class. And there was a certain person, an older person, who in his advanced years, he decided, you know, to get involved in some Jewish learning and to try sort of strengthen the Jewish connection. So he used to come every day to the Talmud class. He didn't understand as much as everyone else did at the table, but he would try, and he had his little English Talmud, and he would revise, and then when after the summer he would try and sort of revise it himself, and he would come back next year. He'd done a few more pages at his own pace, and then he got sick, and he was. But you know, the last summer that he met this Rabbi P, I'm saying Rabbi P, but I don't know his name. This person seemed a bit down. Part to do with his illness, I suppose. So Rabbi P asked him, "Why are you so down?" So he told him, "You know, I've been thinking about it. Like, I'm putting in such effort the last few years to come to this class and to learn and to further my Jewish knowledge and Jewish connection. But I really wonder, like, I'm down there. I'm like a low-level guy. I'm doing one page in 6 months. It's taking me a time. Like, does it really matter? Like, does God really care?" So Rabbi P said that it's such divine providence, because 15 hours before that conversation, he was sitting in his car and he was coming from Brooklyn to the Catskills, right? A trip that he'd made dozens of times, and it was very stuffy and he's getting a bit nervous. So he turned on the radio just to distract his mind. And when he turned on the radio, it was a person talking about classical music, not a topic that Rabbi P was very familiar with. But nevertheless, he was listening to an interview, and the interview obviously was no coincidence. Nothing happens by chance. So what was the interview? They were talking about a very famous musician called Toscanini. I'm not expert in classical music, so I don't know, but he was one of the most acclaimed musicians of the late 19th century or 20th century. And he was very perfect in his music, and he had a deep understanding of music and an unbelievable ear and so on. And the story goes that he was sitting, Tascalini was sitting one day with his biographers. And together they were listening to a recording of a certain symphony, of a certain overture. It was a complicated arrangement, it was very sophisticated. They were listening silently, they were concentrating on every sort of part of the music, right? When we listen to music for entertainment, it's different the way a musician listens to an arrangement, right? So at the end, Toscanini looks up and he says, he asked his colleague, he says, did you notice anything unusual about what we just heard? So the guy says, I have no idea, he confessed, but I'm curious, what was so unusual about this piece of music? So Toscanini turns to him and says, there should have been 14 violins and there were only 13. Right? So the biographer, the guy was sitting with him, he didn't want to laugh in his face, like it was disrespectful. You know, in front of such an amazing musician and conductor. Like, how could he tell that one violinist was missing? But the next day, he did some research, and apparently, to his amazement, it was true. It was apparently the guy was sick or whatever, he didn't show up, and there was one violin missing. So the Rabbi P turns to this rich and he says, have you ever heard of Toscanini? And he told him the story. And he said to him the following, he said, I want you to understand like this. The commoner does not detect nuance. No one listening to that symphony were able to realize that one measly violin was missing. But the master, he can hear everything. He knows exactly how that piece of music is supposed to sound. And that's what makes him so great. So he said, what do you mean? Every person at the table counts. Whether you understand a little bit, you understand a lot. Each person brings their own music. And every note and every violin and every piece is so important. So that's part of what he saw. And it doesn't matter if it's big or small, but it matters that it's a part of the overall orchestra, it's a part of the overall puzzle. And the third thing I want to talk about is what comes out of this is this. It's understanding how to use our specific contribution, right? And this is something that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and this goes back to the chapter in the book, was a theme that ran through so much of the way he related to people. When people would seek guidance from him, he would very rarely allow people, like someone would say, you know, I've seen videos of even this happening, and someone would say, you know, I remember one guy once came to the video of the Rebbe, and he was at the audience, and he says to the Rebbe, you know, I've built up a nice business, I've been doing that for a couple of decades, it's a comfortable business, successful business, I have what I need to live on, and I'd really like to spend more time learning. So I'm thinking of like either retiring or doing it only, giving it up kind of thing. And I'll have enough to live on. I'll dedicate my time to greater things. And the Rebbe didn't let him do it. And so it was a strange thing because it sounded like such an unbelievable thing to do, right? Leave something more mundane and go into something so spiritual. The Rebbe didn't believe in that because he believed, of course, people learning, and he believed he was a fanatic about Jewish learning and about Jewish study. And dedicate time, especially the young people going to yeshiva and all that kind of thing. But he said, if that's where you've arrived, that's where God led you, that's your purpose. What you need to focus on is not leaving it and finding something else to do, which is more obviously holy. What you need to find is, how can you further your purpose, whether it's giving more charity or making more, and not living a materialistic lifestyle, but on the contrary, helping other people, maybe giving jobs to other people, maybe giving charity, whatever the case is. And that was a theme, because that is what really difference and uniqueness and unique contribution is. In Judaism, it's not about finding our own way and that which makes us feel good and sort of talks to us and it makes sense to us and all that kind of stuff. It's not. We are committed to something higher than ourselves. But it does mean to find the talents and the opportunities and the destinations where we've landed, to find out what is it that is unique about that God has given that to me because I'm talented in that area, or that's where I've landed up, or whatever the case is, how can I use that for the common purpose, right? So for example, to the business person, this is how the book reads, I'll read it to you. To the business person, he will explain, to the rebellious young adults, first charting their path in the world, he would explain that their youthful energy is powerful, that they need to use it. He would talk a lot about harnessing. He would talk about youth a lot and about the rebelliousness of the youth. In the 60s, he talked about it a lot, you know. And he said, it's an amazing opportunity. He would tell his emissary, it's an amazing opportunity. These are people looking, these are people being created, these are people actually expanding. and not doing it all is in a good way. But you need to find, you need to be able to harness that. Right? So we get our differences and we get our unique talents and circumstances and so on. Then we have a choice. How do we use them? We can use it for the life of pleasure or we can use it for the life of purpose. And when we lead inspiring other people, we have to help them sort of harness that. So to the businessman, it also explains how they can make their work meaningful by finding opportunities to provide spiritual material help to their colleagues and giving charity and so on and so on. If it was a stay-at-home parent, he would explain how the imprint of early days childhood has a long-term impact on the future of the adult. How that, you know, everything we do is holy. If we use it correctly, it's all holy. So when we come, and we obviously need to dedicate time for common purpose, so we come to a shir and we learn, or we pray, or we do a mitzvah, we strengthen the foundation of who we are. But then the rest of our life, where we're all different, and we have different jobs and different careers and different pathways and different directions, that's also holy if we choose to use it for the common purpose. And we need to try and do that because we each have differences that we need, we each have strengths, we each have weaknesses, we each have strengths that we can harness and use for that purpose. So his philosophy was that once you are committed to the foundation, and we need to continuously be committed to the foundation and strengthen the foundation with the mitzvah, with the prayer, with the learning, with the spirituality, with the divine interaction and so on and so forth, then we need to realize that the rest of us, which is so different from each other, is part and unique and critical to the overall purpose, the overall music, and the overall symphony, and we need to learn how to use that for the purpose, and it becomes no less holy than prayer, or something openly divine, right? There was a woman called Marcia Greenside or something. Anyway, she had a degree in psychology, and she started to work in psychology, and then that was a sort of a job, a day job, and then she got involved in the Chabad in San Diego, and she used to volunteer there a lot, and she was loving it and really, really getting into it. And she wrote to the Rebbe, and she said the following. She said, she wrote how old I was and what I was doing, and she said, my secular job, I wrote, was at UCLA, and then I went to say that I considered my activities at Chabad House to be my real work. At that time, my passion lay in the work at the Chabad House, and I considered my research work in the Institute to be simply a job. So, you know, I told you that the Rebbe would often answer things by circling things on letters and things like that, right? So she said, where I'd written my secular job, the Rebbe crossed out secular, leaving just my job. And then he put in the margin, the purpose of which is the emotional well-being and healing of children. That's not just a job. That's not a secular. That's a purpose. And you used to see it as a purpose, right? So she went full steam ahead and got really involved in her job, while furthering her connection, you know, Chabad activities and her Judaism and so on and so forth. And she became her life work. And she became a big therapist and helps hundreds of kids and so on and so forth. Because that's part of her purpose. That was her unique contribution. The Rebbe would often tell people, once you've arrived at a certain point, like once, you know, there were, you know, the Rebbe was a big fan of boys when they finish school to go first to yeshiva for a good few years. Even before they do any job or pursue any career, they should immerse themselves in Torah study. And there was this thing, and it was controversial at the time, because at the time, you know, everyone said you have to have a degree, otherwise you won't have a job and so on. And that was controversial. He said, first you have to strengthen your Judaism, then that's the source of all blessing, and then you'll worry about it. But very interestingly enough, there were many, many people who became religious later in life, while they were already in the middle of a course, the middle of a degree, right? And there were many people, I know many people, that they became very, very involved in religion, and then they just wanted to leave it and go to yeshiva and just, you know, and the Rebbe wouldn't let them. As much as he encouraged kids when they finished school to go to yeshiva, once divine providence had it that the person had landed up in a particular pathway, the Rebbe said, you have to go to shiurim, you have to learn as much as you can, but you have a purpose. You need to stay. This, I told you the story of Professor Bronover and others. He would make them stay, and not only stay, he would encourage them to go on and to do a PhD and to all kinds of things, because that's where you've landed. That means you need to find your purpose there. Your Jewish purpose, your godly purpose, right? So those are the principles. That's the unique contribution that we all have. And when a person is particularly in a dark space, this is the point of emotional well-being, that this is such an important message. Often, being dark or being down or being depressed even comes from a dark place, and it comes from a feeling of emptiness. And part of how you fill that feeling of emptiness is to understand this message. You are important as an individual, Yes, you submit to a higher purpose and a common purpose and a shared mission, but your particular contribution to that shared mission is so critical, and it's a hard thing in a way. To surrender to the foundation is hard, but then to understand how you make such a difference, your little contribution makes such a difference, is actually very empowering and very strengthening. And that's part of why, whether it's understanding where you landed up is where you're meant to be, or understanding your particular strengths and talents, or understanding even small things are so important, that becomes a very empowering and strengthening thing. So just before we finish, just again to remind everyone that next week is the last one, but then I'm going to start an 8-week WhatsApp learning. So take a thing and subscribe to the WhatsApp, and see you next week, and have a wonderful week. Mm-hmm.